This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm David Lipson. Tonight, the Prime Minister resists growing calls for rapid tests to be made free nationally, but even those willing to pay can't get their hands on them. We speak with an ICU nurse who's suspected COVID positive, but under pressure to return to work.
I'm still within the 7 days of close contact with my daughter testing positive, and my PCR test hasn't still been returned yet. I wasn't even in isolation for 1 day before the phone call started to return to duty.
Also, a warning the economy could be stunted long term unless the door is opened more widely to skilled migrants.
What we risk is that those migrants will find a home somewhere else. We know that we're in competition with Canada and the United Kingdom, and if we take too long to open our borders and attract those people to Australia, they'll simply go somewhere else.
Happy New Year. Well, familiar old issues of procurement and foresight, or lack thereof, are dogging the federal government as the pandemic rolls into a third year. Tens of thousands of new cases have been recorded across the nation today, and hospitalisations continue to climb. Experts warn the real number of cases in the community is likely to be a lot higher, partly because of the change in criteria for who should seek a PCR swab, but also because people can't get their hands on rapid antigen testing kits, or they simply can't afford them. The Prime Minister says it's up to Australians to pay for rapid tests themselves, as Queensland becomes the latest state to secure its own batch of millions of rat kits, as they're known, that it says it'll hand out for free. Rhett Burney reports.
Like so many Australians, 33-year-old Canberra woman Amy has spent a lot of time trying to track down COVID rapid antigen tests.
So I looked everywhere in Canberra, spent about a week trying to find some. I've only just been able to get some, and that's because I'm visiting friends in Adelaide. Went to the chemist here, they were able to order some and then get some in for myself and my friends. But in Canberra, we were just told out of stock, not sure when they're getting them in.
Amy paid $15 per test, a cost that she said she was willing to pay.
Fine for me, who has a job and can afford it, but I mean, I imagine there's a number of people who won't be able to afford them at $15.
Retailers Harvey Norman and Dick Smith are cashing in on the demand for rapid antigen testing kits too. They've already sold out, and some online stores are charging as much as $45 for a single test. Professor Nancy Baxter is an epidemiologist and the head of the School of Population and Global Health at Melbourne Uni. She's been pleading with the federal government to supply them for free.
When we changed the definition of a close contact, you know, we didn't change the biology of the disease. We didn't change the transmission of the disease. So there are a lot of people who may be in contact with someone at work or in social settings who are close contacts, you know, when in the true definition of the term, but don't meet the criteria for testing with PCR. Honestly, the governments can bulk buy these things, they can source them, they can distribute them. They have the mechanism with which to get this done that, you know, we as a community, even if we want to, don't have.
Prime Minister Scott Morrison has told Channel 7 that's not going to happen.
But when it comes to this pandemic, we've had JobKeeper, we've had business supports, we've had the COVID disaster payments. We've invested hundreds of billions of dollars getting Australia through this crisis. But we're now in a stage of the pandemic where you can't just make everything free, because when someone tells you they want to make something free, someone's always going to pay for it, and it's going to be you.
This afternoon, the Queensland government announced it secured 18 million COVID rapid antigen testing kits that it'll provide for free at testing sites to people classified as close contacts and COVID-19 positive cases who require further testing under a public health direction. Victoria ordered 34 million of the tests just before Christmas. They're expected to arrive this week, and they'll be provided to residents for free. Health Minister Martin Foley says the states and territories are stepping in to do the work of the federal government.
What we're seeing consistently from the Prime Minister is his ability to transfer responsibility to the states. That's just the way this Prime Minister operates. The states clearly have a view that freely available rapid antigen testing as part of an ongoing response to Omicron forms part of what should be a national response. We've seen right across the globe that freely available, readily distributed rapid antigen tests form a key part of ongoing responses to the global pandemic.
But Scott Morrison says that model is bad for business.
The private market, whether it's in the big warehouse pharmacies or the other pharmacies or the supermarkets, they can now go and stock their shelves with confidence that they won't be undercut by the government.
There have also been calls, including from a leading pharmacy chain, for the government to drop the GST on rapid antigen tests to make them more affordable. Health Minister Greg Hunt argues that's up to the states to decide, as was the case with GST on women's sanitary products.
That's entirely a matter for the states. Prime Minister, myself, the Treasurer have discussed it. That money doesn't go to the Commonwealth. That goes to the states. It took a long while for us, the Prime Minister and the Treasurer and myself in our different roles at the time worked to have that GST removed on sanitary products. It took a lot of convincing for some of the states.
Epidemiologist Nancy Baxter says public health needs to come first, and she warns the current supply block of rapid antigen tests and the fact that they're not free to everyone will have already skewed the known number of cases in the community.
The cases that are officially recorded are only the tip of the iceberg. So we really don't know where we're at in terms of the number of cases. All your listeners should assume that there are many cases out there in the community that are undiagnosed. And so your chances of encountering someone with COVID who doesn't know they have COVID, doesn't have access to testing, doesn't know that they were in contact with somebody with COVID, that number is just increasing. So you can kind of assume when you go to the grocery store that somebody in that grocery store is going to be in that circumstance.
That's epidemiologist Nancy Baxter ending Rhett Burney's report. Melbourne's Western Health put out a message today about emergency departments in Sunshine, Footscray and Williamstown hospitals being under extreme pressure. Please do not attend the ED unless absolutely necessary, it pleaded. Various governments are offering assurances that their systems will cope with what's to come, but some independent experts are worried. One thing we do know is hospital workers are already exhausted and increasingly short-staffed, as more and more of them are isolated due to COVID. Michelle Rosentreter is a senior ICU nurse at a major metropolitan hospital and a member of the New South Wales Nurses and Midwives Association. She told me earlier she has suspected COVID, but has been under pressure to return to the ward.
So I'm currently on isolation and I'm still within the 7 days of close contact with my daughter testing positive. And I've got very mild symptoms, so I haven't been able to return to work even under the change in the guidelines for asymptomatic staff returning to work.
Did your work ask you to go back?
They have. They've been. I wasn't even in isolation for 1 day before the phone call started to return to duty.
Even and though my daughter was you're symptomatic, even though your daughter's positive?
Yeah, I was mildly symptomatic and my daughter was grossly symptomatic and positive. And my PCR test hasn't still been returned yet. So, no, I haven't returned to work or returned to duty.
You declined.
For concerns of, I declined, yeah.
Do you think you've got COVID?
I think I might have a very mild case of COVID, yes.
The fact that your work is urging you to return really sums up the position that health policy decision makers are in. They need frontline health staff at work, even if there is a significant risk they may be COVID positive.
Correct. And the measures within the workplace are such that the 95 and goggles, the 95 mask and goggles are never to be removed. There's no common area for staff that should be isolating that have been recalled. There's no area for them to go where they can remove that mask safely to have a drink or have something to eat. Not allowed to use common areas, not allowed to go anywhere. So basically minimise the risk completely of the possibility that you may be infectious and could actually take out your colleagues by being at work, by having one exposure. So of strict rules on not removing any protection.
What's your assessment of the situation in hospitals in New South Wales right now?
Oh, look, I am confident in saying that the prevailing sentiment amongst the nurses and midwives at the moment is that hospitals should not be considered a front line. I strongly believe that should be seen with free tests and availability of risk mitigation.
So has that changed for you? Because, you know, we often call you frontline health workers, but really the front line for COVID up until very recently has been the testing, the contact tracing. But those testing pressures are so great now. What you're saying, you're often the first line of defence.
Yes. And honestly, as I said, it really is quite a prevailing sentiment. And it's come about from conversations and surveys and feedback from across the state, and not just amongst myself and my own colleagues, but from those that are working in similar areas. And just that sentiment is hospitals aren't frontline. They're there to treat people and manage diseases and emergencies. And our emergency departments are buckling. And, solutions really should lie in the leadership.
What do you mean by the emergency departments are buckling?
The emergency departments, as with every other ward and specialty in a hospital, it just hasn't ceased. So actually, since the pandemic started, our workloads have significantly, if not moderately, increased. And we've seen this in roster shortfalls and increase in patient numbers regardless of their diagnosis. So the pressure's never off. And our EDs, they've never been able to relax or really catch their breath. It has just been a constant stream of more and more. That's the front door of your hospital. Anybody who gets admitted from there is still going to go and feel these pressures in the wards and the ICUs.
Because governments are saying that hospitalisations and people in intensive care units are still, you know, well below what they were at the peak of Delta, and that hospitals are in a good position to manage what's to come. What do you say to that?
It's a hard pill to swallow, to be fair. Your presentation to hospital and your usage of specialty areas like intensive care, it's got nothing to do whether or not you're got a diagnosis, secondary as it might be, say with COVID, is that surgeries were still happening. Patients were still having heart attacks and arrests and other very grave illnesses that required the services. So it's not like the admissions just stopped when Delta settled down. They kept coming, and the communities and the patients, they're sick. They need that service, but the workforce itself is quite skeleton compared to what it could be if there was a greater investment recruitment and stabilising workforces.
We're hearing some claims in New South Wales that the hospital numbers are somewhat inflated because they include people who present to hospital with other conditions, say a broken bone, and are then determined later to have COVID, or at the time to have COVID, which means they've at that point got a mild case of COVID. They didn't even know they had it, but are being counted as a COVID case in hospital.
Correct. Not everybody in hospital that's diagnosed with COVID presented to hospital because of a respiratory or upper respiratory illness. They were there for other reasons and other conditions, and it was a secondary finding that they actually had the virus.
But they still then need to be treated very carefully, don't they, and take a lot more care.
Correct. So we've one thing all the LHDs have managed to do is find out what worked well and what didn't when it came to infection control and how we manage the trigger points for various presentations of infectious diseases. I think healthcare workers are exceptional in there, and in all of ours, we're very good with our infection control. And that is found in the statistics when you find what in-hospital transmissions may have happened.
Indeed, because we need to be clear, even though it's a somewhat scary picture that you paint regarding our hospitals, we don't want anyone avoiding hospital care if they need it.
No, you need, if you are unwell and you need the hospital, you need to come. You don't want to be sitting at home battling with something that you can't manage with Panadol and Nurofen, or if it's a broken bone or something more sinister. You know, it's just a pressured stress system that you're coming into. So remember to be kind to your clinicians. It's frustrations are there with us as well as with those that we look after, because we may not be able to treat you as quickly or see you as quickly as you would like.
Michelle Rosentreter, thanks so much for talking to us. Hope you feel better.
Thank you so much. Take care.
That's Michelle Rosentreter, a senior ICU nurse and a member of the New South Wales Nurses and Midwives Association. Experts are warning of yet another looming crunch point. Next week, vaccinations begin for children aged 5 to 11. The Federal Health Minister is urging parents to book their kids in as soon as possible. But those delivering the jabs say they're already stretched because of the rush on boosters, and they're concerned that many primary school-aged children won't be protected before they start the school year. Emily Burke reports.
This time next week, Australian children from the age of 5 to 11 will be eligible to roll up their sleeves for a COVID vaccine.
Not all of these will occur on the one day.
The Federal Health Minister, Greg Hunt, has a message for parents and carers.
It's absolutely in your child's interest to have them vaccinated over the course of the coming weeks.
But there are doubts about just how smooth this rollout will be. Melbourne GP and Deputy Chair of the General Practice Alliance, Dr. Mukesh Haikerwal, says he's not expecting doses to arrive until next week.
We're telling people not to make any calls about that because we can't tell them when the vaccine clinic will be for children. We're not expecting vaccines until the 10th of January when the doses for children are being delivered.
The Health Minister, Greg Hunt, says that's not the case.
Frankly, it's wrong. It's just wrong. During the course of this week, in the lead up to January the 10th, the doses are made available.
Victoria has announced that state hubs will be used to deliver the jabs for younger children, and bookings can be made from tomorrow. And pharmacies are gearing up as well.
My son and my daughter will be one of the first in Australia to receive it on Monday morning the 10th. And I wouldn't recommend to any of my patients, and I wouldn't recommend to any of your listeners, to do something for their children that I wasn't prepared to do for my own.
The Pharmacy Guild's Trent Toomey says 1,300 pharmacists who signed up to administer doses will be stretched, and this is why.
We have 3 points of acceleration in our vaccination program happening in January. The first one is obviously on the 4th, where the vaccination booster schedule will drop down to 4 months. Then we have on Monday the 10th, we have the commencement of the childhood vaccination program. And then on the 31st of January, we've got the dropping of the booster window down to 3 months. So there are 3 points of acceleration happening. It's going to be a stretch on all of us. But I'm hoping that more pharmacies will come on board in that second ordering fortnight.
But distribution to GPs remains an issue. Anna Davidson is Director of Port Stephens GPs.
The clinic that I have, we've been allocated 50 vaccines a week. Most general practices that I've spoken to, and it's a lot, I'm in a forum with 7,000 other general practice managers around Australia, most people have had 50 vaccines a week. So I just don't know, when you look at the number of children that we're going to have to vaccinate, how that's going to translate to a quick rollout.
And then there's the gap between the first and second doses.
So it will take us maybe 2 to 3 months minimum to vaccinate all our children between 5 and 12 that want to take the vaccine up, and then 8 weeks later do that again.
Dr. Davidson is concerned about the consequences of unvaccinated children returning or starting school in late January.
Without it getting out as quickly as possible, we're going to see infections in kids. We need to look at what options we've got for clinically vulnerable kids. We need to really get into safe air at schools and masks, and we've got to look at children under 5 because they are nowhere near on the radar for vaccination, and yet they are at risk.
Is it worth considering delaying the start of the term 1 to get more kids vaccinated? Is that an option that we should be really looking hard at?
Personally, I think that is a really sensible option. Well, imagine if we had a figure of, well, at 80% first vax, we can open schools. I mean, it's the figure that the government themselves used to justify opening up. I just wonder why no one's looking at that for children.
Professor Mike Toole from the Burnett Institute says the strategy to get kids vaccinated is missing a vital element, communication.
So we reassure parents that this vaccine is very safe. It's been given to more than 5 million children in the US, and there have been reports of lower or a rarer side effects than in adolescents and adults. It is just a fraction of the dose for adults. So it's very safe for children. It's very effective, particularly we need every child in that age group to get at least one dose before they go back to school. And that's going to require a big effort.
That's Professor Mike Toole from the Burnet Institute, ending Emily Burke's report. You're listening to PM on radio on the ABC Listen app and via podcast. I'm David Lipson. There are warnings tonight of disastrous consequences for the economy if Australia misses out on the millions of skilled migrants now ready to travel abroad. The government's opened the door to some international students and skilled migrants, but the intake falls well short of what economists say the country needs. Business reporter David Taylor has the story.
Over the past 2 years, the number of skilled migrants has plummeted to a net intake of roughly 50,000 workers. KPMG chief economist Brendan Rinn says that number needs to rise, and fast.
What we need to see is additional migration come to Australia at around about 350,000 net overseas migrants per annum for the period till 2029.
Dr. Rinn says over the next decade, Australia needs to absorb another 2.5 million people. And if not, well, Brendan Rinn says it'll cause great economic harm.
Well, what we risk is that those migrants will find a home somewhere else. We know that we're in competition with countries like Canada and the United Kingdom for skilled migrants. And there's only a certain talent pool of people globally that we're looking to fill in terms of the skills that we've got that shortfall in. And so post-COVID, there's going to be competitive world environment for skilled migrants. And if we take too long to open our borders and attract those people to Australia, they'll simply go somewhere else.
The demand for skilled migrants is certainly there, according to the latest official jobs data. The preliminary estimates based on Tax Office single touch payroll data show there were around 485,000 more jobs by the end of November last year, compared to the trough during the Delta outbreak. Treasurer Josh Frydenberg.
Australia's experiencing a jobs boom. We've seen nearly 500,000 new jobs created since September as our two largest states, New South Wales and Victoria, come out of lockdown.
But the government's unlikely to open the floodgates before May, which is the month by which the next general election must be held. Josh Frydenberg has flagged the government has no intention of rolling out more aggressive net migration targets.
So that's why it's important that we open our borders in a COVID-safe way. We bring in those skilled workers, we bring in those international students, because that will help our economy grow.
So which is it then? Is Australia in desperate need of more skilled migrants, or do we have time on our side? Well, Richard Dennis is the chief economist of the think tank, the Australia Institute. He says bigger questions need to be asked about Australia's current capacity to absorb hundreds of thousands more people every year.
This idea that unless we have a lot more customers in Australia, unless we have a lot more people in Australia, the economy will go to hell in a handbasket. Well, that's never been true here in Australia, and it's certainly not true in other countries around the world that have much lower growth rates in population than we do.
Is it better for workers' wages, generally speaking, to have more skilled migrants come in to ultimately lead to higher productivity and higher wages? Or is it better to have fewer skilled migrants come in? What boosts wages ultimately?
Look, the main thing that determines wage growth is actually wages policy. We've spent 20 years in Australia trying to keep wages growth down, and we've succeeded. We've had very low wage growth in Australia, even though we've had very high rates of immigration. So the idea that if only we had high rates of immigration, wages would go up, well, that doesn't really explain what's happened for the last 15 years.
Once borders are fully open, business groups are also calling for the annual cap on permanent skilled migration to be lifted from 160,000 people to 200,000 people.
That's our business reporter David Taylor reporting there. A group of Darwin Indigenous community leaders and a local QC are promising to maintain a weekly protest outside the city's notorious Dondale Youth Detention Centre until it's closed. The NT's Youth Detention Royal Commission recommended the centre's closure 4 years ago after outrage over children being shackled to chairs and tear gassed. The NT government denies accusations. It's reneging on its commitment to replace the centre with better facilities and programs. Jane Barden reports.
For a second week, a small but determined group lined Dondale's fence. The government says it stopped shackling and spit-hooding teenagers in Dondale, but it's continuing practices like long isolation. The centre is an old condemned adult prison, which the children were moved to in 2015 after some damaged and broke out of the original Dondale facility. Larrakia elder June Mills.
We're not putting up with it anymore. We've had enough, right? We're going to be here and we're going to be here and we're going to be in your face until we begin to get something that looks like what we want.
We all know here, and that's why we're here, that this is fundamentally wrong and it's obscene.
QC John Lawrence says going in and out of Dondale to cells which brought one of the Royal Commissioners to tears is damaging one of his clients, a traumatised 11-year-old boy. The boy is on remand facing charges including shoplifting.
At the moment, because they've got staff shortages, he's only allowed out of his cell during the day three times, 1 hour at a time. And then at 6:30 he's back in. So it's barbarism. It's horrendous. I mean, you wouldn't put a convicted criminal male in conditions like that. This is a child who himself is damaged. He's clearly got mental psychological problems caused by living in a household full of trauma. And his case doesn't come on till late April. So he is facing the prospect, if he doesn't get bail again, he would be in there for 4 months.
The NT government accepted the Royal Commission's recommendation to close Dondale in 2017. It promised in 2020 that construction on a new 30-bed purpose-built centre would be completed this year, but it's to be built beside the Holtz Adult Prison, against the Commission's recommendation. 33 kids are now in Dondale, 96% of them Indigenous. One is a relative of Natalie Hunter, a founder of the North Australian Aboriginal Justice Agency.
The Royal Commission says shut down Dondale. The government needs to get it in their head. Locking up 10-year-olds in a cage that was not fit for adults, that they are locking our children up at 10 years old.
More teenagers are being detained since the government passed laws in May criminalising breach of bail. And Ms Hunter says she's been dismayed that the Territory Families Minister, Kate Warden, has rejected a proposal she submitted for an alternative to detention.
I believe that we need a trauma school, a healing place for our children, not Dondale. The government needs to start listening to the people instead of just worrying about their votes. And I think they've lost it now in how the treatment of Aboriginal people in the Northern Territory. To me, it's pure racism. Kate Warden needs to step down.
Gurindji woman Josie Crawshaw says she's watched inadequately addressed stolen generation trauma contribute to incarceration of her family members.
I've had a nephew in jail twice. I've got my own grandson at the moment that's in drug and alcohol rehabilitation place, because they've all been part of seeing trauma in the house, and that's what a lot of the jail population is.
She was the head of the NT's now defunded Indigenous Child Protection Agency and says the government must invest in more therapeutic responses.
Because we're looking at genocide, because they've had every report and they've done sweet F.A.
The NT Families Minister Kate Warden responded with a statement saying the new youth detention centre will be finished this year and the government is funding youth diversion programmes as well. She said the new facility's design will strike a balance between ensuring it's safe and secure while meeting the therapeutic needs of the young people. Lawyer John Lawrence expects the government to try to ignore the protests, but hopes the public won't allow that.
This government is only interested, like so many, in retaining power in government. And so what we've reached now is an impasse, and what we are doing now is another limb of democracy, which is direct action. taken by people who realise that it's the only prospect of ever achieving any change that is required.
That's QC John Lawrence talking to Jane Barden in Darwin. That's all we've got time for on this edition of PM. I'm David Lipson. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.